Mitya, I know you'll tell the whole truth, said Alyosha in agitation.
I am telling it. If I tell the whole truth just as it happened, I shan't spare myself. My first idea was a Karamazov one. Once I was bitten by a centipede, brother, and laid up for a fortnight with fever from it. Well, I felt a centipede biting at my heart then. A noxious insect, you understand? I looked her up and down. You've seen her. She's a beauty. But she was beautiful in another way then. At that moment she was beautiful because she was noble, and I was a scoundrel. She, in all the grandeur of her generosity and sacrifice for her father, and I, a bug. And scoundrel as I was, she was altogether at my mercy, body and soul. She was hemmed in. I tell you frankly, that thought, that venomous thought, so possessed my heart that it almost swooned with suspense. It seemed as if there could be no resisting it, as though I should act like a bug, like a venomous spider, without a spark of pity. I could scarcely breathe. Understand, I should have gone next day to ask for a hand, so that it might end honourably, so to speak, and that nobody would or could know. For, though I'm a man of base desires, I'm honest, and at that very second some voice seemed to whisper in my ear. But when you come tomorrow to make your proposal, that girl won't even see you. She'll order her coachman to kick you out of the yard. Publish it through all the town, she would say. I'm not afraid of you. I looked at the young lady. My voice had not deceived me. That is how it would be, not a doubt of it. I could see from her face now that I should be turned out of the house. My spite was roused. I longed to play her the nastiest swinish cad's trick. To look at her with a sneer, and on the spot where she stood before me, to stun her with a tone of voice that only a shopman could use.
4,000? What do you mean? I was joking. You've been counting your chickens too easily, madam. 200, if you like, with all my heart. But 4,000 is not a sum to throw away on such frivolity. You put yourself out to no purpose.
I should have lost the game, of course. She'd have run away. But it would have been an infernal revenge. It would have been worth it all. I'd have howled with regret all the rest of my life, only to have played that trick. Would you believe me, it has never happened to me with any other woman, not one, to look at her at such a moment with hatred. But on my oath I looked at her for 3 seconds, or 5 perhaps, with fearful hatred. That hate which is only a hair's breadth from love, from the maddest love. I went to the window, put my forehead against the frozen pane, and I remember the ice burnt my forehead like fire. I did not keep her long, don't be afraid. I turned round, went up to the table, opened the drawer, and took out a banknote for 5,000 rubles. It was lying in a French dictionary. Then I showed it her in silence, folded it, handed it to her, opened the door into the passage, and stepping back made her a deep bow. A most respectful, a most impressive bow, believe me. She shuddered all over, gazed at me for a second, turned horribly pale, white as a sheet, in fact, and all at once, not impetuously, but softly, gently, bowed down to my feet, not a boarding-school curtsy, but a Russian bow with her forehead to the floor. She jumped up and ran away. I was wearing my sword. I drew it and nearly stabbed myself with it on the spot. Why, I don't know, would have been frightfully stupid, of course. I suppose it was from delight. Can you understand that one might kill oneself from delight? But I didn't stab myself. I only kissed my sword and put it back in the scabbard, which there was no need to have told you, by the way. And I fancy that in telling you about my inner conflict, I've laid it on rather thick to glorify myself, but let it pass, and to hell with all who pry into the human heart. Well, so much for that adventure. Katerina Ivanovna, so now Ivan knows of it, and you, no one else.
Dmitri got up, took a step or two in his excitement, pulled out his handkerchief and mopped his forehead, then sat down again, not in the same place as before, but on the opposite side, so that Alyosha had to turn quite round to face him. Chapter 5. The Confession of a Passionate Heart Heals Up. "Now," said Alyosha, "I understand the first half."
"You understand the first half. That half is a drama, and it was played out there. The second half is a tragedy, and it is being acted here."
"And I understand nothing of that second half so far," said Alyosha.
"And I, do you suppose I understand it?"
"Stop, Dmitri, there's one important question. Tell me, you were betrothed. You are betrothed still."
"We weren't betrothed at once, not for 3 months after that adventure. The next day I told myself that the incident was closed, concluded, that there would be no sequel. It seemed to me caddish to make her an offer. On her side she gave me sign of life for the 6 weeks that she remained in the town. Except, indeed, for one action. The day after her visit the maid-servant slipped round with an envelope addressed to me. I tore it open. It contained the change out of the banknote. Only 4,500 was needed, but there was a discount of about 200 on changing it. She only sent me about 260 rubles, I don't remember exactly, but not a note, not a word of explanation. I searched the packet for a pencil mark. Nothing. Well, I spent the rest of the money on such an orgy that the new major was obliged to reprimand me. Well, the lieutenant colonel produced the battalion money, to the astonishment of everyone, for nobody believed that he had the money untouched. He'd no sooner paid it than he fell ill, took to his bed, and 3 weeks later softening of the brain set in, and he died 5 days afterwards. He was buried with military honours, for he'd not had time to receive his discharge. 10 days after his funeral, Katerina Ivanovna, with her aunt and sister, went to Moscow, and behold, on the very day they went away. I hadn't seen them, didn't see them off or take leave. I received a tiny note, a sheet of thin blue paper, and on it only one line in pencil. I will write to you. Wait. K. And that was all. I'll explain the rest now in 2 words. In Moscow their fortunes changed with the swiftness of lightning and the unexpectedness of an Arabian fairy tale. That general's widow, their nearest relation, suddenly lost the 2 nieces who were her heiresses and next of kin. Both died in the same week of smallpox. The old lady, prostrated with grief, welcomed Katya as her daughter, as her one hope, clutched at her, altered her will in Katya's favour. But that concerned the future. Meanwhile, she gave her, for present use, 80,000 rubles as a marriage portion to do what she liked with. She was an hysterical woman. I saw something of her in Moscow later. Well, suddenly I received by post 4,500 rubles. I was speechless with surprise, as you may suppose. 3 days later came the promised letter. I have it with me now. I always keep it, and I shall keep it till I die. Shall I show you? You must read it. She offers to be my wife, offers herself to me. I love you madly, she says. Even if you don't love me, never mind. Be my husband. Don't be afraid. I won't hamper you in any way. I will be your chattel. I will be the carpet under your feet. I want to love you forever. I want to save you from yourself. Alyosha, I'm not worthy to repeat those lines in my vulgar words and in my vulgar tone, my everlastingly vulgar tone, that I can never cure myself of. That letter stabs me even now. Do you think I don't mind, that I don't mind still? I wrote her an answer at once. As it was impossible for me to go to Moscow, I wrote to her with tears. One thing I shall be ashamed of forever. I referred to her being rich and having a dowry, while I was only a stuck-up beggar. I mention money. I ought to have borne it in silence, but it slipped from my pen. Then I wrote at once to Ivan and told him all I could about it in a letter of 6 pages, and sent him to her. Why do you look like this? Why are you staring at me? Yes, Ivan fell in love with her. He's in love with her still, I know that. I did a stupid thing in the world's opinion, but perhaps that one stupid thing may be the saving of us all now. Oh, don't you see what a lot she thinks of Ivan, how she respects him? When she compares us, do you suppose she can love a man like me, especially after all that has happened here?
But I'm convinced that she does love a man like you, and not a man like him.
She loves her own virtue, not me.
The words broke involuntarily and almost malignantly from Dmitri. He laughed. But a minute later his eyes gleamed. He flushed crimson, struck the table violently with his fist.
I swear, Alyosha, he cried,
with intense and genuine anger at himself.
You may not believe me, but as God is holy and as Christ is God, I swear that though I smiled at her lofty sentiments just now, I know that I am a million times baser in soul than she, and that these lofty sentiments of hers are as sincere as a heavenly angel's. That's the tragedy of it, that I know that for certain. What if anyone does show off a bit? Don't I do it myself? And yet I'm sincere. I'm sincere. As for Ivan, I can understand how he must be cursing nature now, with his intellect, to see the preference given to whom, to what? To a monster who, though he is betrothed and all eyes are fixed on him, can't restrain his debaucheries, and before the very eyes of his betrothed. And a man like me is preferred while he is rejected. And why? Because a girl wants to sacrifice her life and destiny out of gratitude. It's ridiculous. I never said a word of this to Ivan, and Ivan, of course, has never dropped a hint of the sort to me, but destiny will be accomplished, and the best man will hold his ground, while the undeserving one will vanish into his back alley forever. His filthy back alley, his beloved back alley, where he is at home and where he will sink in filth and stench at his own free will and with enjoyment. I've been talking foolishly. I've no words left. I use them at random, but it will be as I've said. I shall drown in the back alley, and she will marry Ivan.
Stop, Dmitri. Alyosha interrupted again with great anxiety. There's one thing you haven't made clear yet. You're still betrothed all the same, aren't you? How can you break off the engagement if she, your betrothed, doesn't want to?
Yes, formally and solemnly betrothed. It was all done on my arrival in Moscow with great ceremony, with icons, all in fine style. The general's wife blessed us and, would you believe it, congratulated Katya. You made a good choice, she said. I see right through him. And would you believe it, she didn't like it, Ivan, and hardly greeted him. I had a lot of talk with Katya in Moscow. I told her about myself sincerely, honorably. She listened to everything. There was sweet confusion. There were tender words. Though there were proud words, too, she wrung out of me a mighty promise to reform. I gave my promise, and here... What? Why, I called you and brought you out here today, this very day. Remember it. To send you, this very day, again, to Katerina Ivanovna and...
What?
To tell her that I shall never come to see her again, say, he sends you his compliments.
But is that possible?
That's just the reason I'm sending you in my place, because it's impossible. Now could I tell her myself?
And where are you going?
To the back alley.
To Grushenka, then?
Alyosha exclaimed, mournfully clasping his hands.
Can Rakitin really have told the truth? I thought that you just visited her and that was all.
Can a betrothed man pay such visits? Is such a thing possible, and with such a betrothed, and before the eyes of all the world? Confounded, I have some honour. As soon as I began visiting Grushenka, I ceased to be betrothed and to be an honest man. I understand that. Why do you look at me? You see, I went in the first place to beat her. I'd heard, and I know for a fact now, that that captain, father's agent, had given Grushenka an IOU of mine for her to sue me for payment so as to put an end to me. They wanted to scare me. I went to beat her. I'd had a glimpse of her before. She doesn't strike one at first sight. I knew about her old merchant who's lying ill now, paralyzed. But he's leaving her a decent little sum. I knew, too, that she was fond of money, that she hoarded it and lent it at a wicked rate of interest, that she's a merciless cheat and swindler. I went to beat her, and I stayed. The storm broke, it struck me down, like the plague. I'm plague-stricken still, and I know that everything is over, that there will never be anything more for me. The cycle of the ages is accomplished. That's my position, and though I'm a beggar, as fate would have it, I had 3,000 just then in my pocket. I drove with Grushenka to Mokroe, a place 25 versts from here. I got gypsies there and champagne and made all the peasants there drunk on it, and all the women and girls. I sent the thousands flying. In 3 days' time I was stripped bare, but a hero. Do you suppose the hero had gained his end? Not a sign of it from her. I tell you, that rogue Krushenka has a supple curve all over her body. You can see it in her little foot, even in her little toe. I saw it and kissed it. But that was all, I swear. I'll marry you if you like, she said. You're a beggar, you know. Say that you won't beat me and will let me do anything I choose, and perhaps I'll marry you. She laughed, and she's laughing still.
Dmitri leapt up with a sort of fury. He seemed all at once as though he were drunk. His eyes became suddenly bloodshot. And do you really mean to marry her?
At once, if she will, and if she won't, I shall stay all the same. I'll be the porter at her gate. Alyosha, he cried.
He stopped short before him, and taking him by the shoulders, began shaking him violently.
Do you know, you innocent boy, that this is all delirium, senseless delirium, for there's a tragedy here. Let me tell you, Alexei, that I may be a low man with low and degraded passions, but a thief and a pickpocket, Dmitri Karamazov never can be.
Well, then, let me tell you that I am a thief and a pickpocket. That very morning, just before I went to beat Grushenka,
Katerina Ivanovna sent for me, and in strict secrecy, why, I don't know, I suppose she had some reason, asked me to go to the chief town of the province and to post 3,000 rubles to Agafya Ivanovna in Moscow, so that nothing should be known of it in the town here. So, I had that 3,000 rubles in my pocket when I went to see Grushenka, and it was that money we spent at Makroy. Afterwards, I pretended I'd been to the town, but did not show her the post office receipt. I said I'd sent the money and would bring the receipt, and so far I haven't brought it. I've forgotten it. Now what do you think you're going to her today to say? He sends his compliments, and she'll ask you, what about the money? You might still have said to her, he's a degraded sensualist and a low creature with uncontrolled passions. He didn't send your money then, but wasted it because, like a low brute, he couldn't control himself. But still you might have added, he isn't a thief, though. Here is your 3,000. He sends it back. Send it yourself to Agafya Ivanovna. But he told me to say he sends his compliments. But, as it is, she will ask, but where is the money?
Mitya, you're unhappy, yes, but not as unhappy as you think. Don't worry yourself to death with despair.
What? Do you suppose I'd shoot myself because I can't get 3,000 to pay back? That's just it. I shan't shoot myself. I haven't the strength now. Afterwards, perhaps, but now I'm going to Grushenka. Don't care what happens.
And what then?
I'll be her husband if she deigns to have me. And when lovers come, I'll go into the next room. I'll clean her friends' galoshes, blow up their samovar, run their errands.
Katerina Ivanovna will understand it all, Alyosha said solemnly. She'll understand how great this trouble is, and will forgive. She has a lofty mind, and no one could be more unhappy than you. She'll see that for herself.
She won't forgive everything, said Dmitri with a grin. There's something in it, brother, that no woman could forgive. Do you know what would be the best thing to do?
What?
Pay back the 3,000.
Where can we get it from? I say, I have 2,000. Ivan will give you another 1,000. That makes 3. Take it and pay it back.
And when would you get it, your 3,000? You're not of age, besides, and you absolutely must take my farewell to her today, with the money or without it, for I can't drag on any longer. Things have come to such a pass. Tomorrow is too late. I shall send you to father.
To father?
Yes, to father. First ask him for 3,000.
But, Mitya, he won't give it.
As though he would. I know he won't. Do you know the meaning of despair, Alexei?
Yes.
Listen, legally he owes me nothing. I've had it all from him. I know that. But morally he owes me something, doesn't he? You know, he started with 28,000 of my mother's money and made 100,000 with it. Let him give me back only 3 out of the 28,000, and he'll draw my soul out of hell, and it will atone for many of his sins. For that 3,000, I give you my solemn word, I'll make an end of everything, and he shall hear nothing more of me. For the last time, I give him the chance to be a father. Tell him, God himself sends him this chance.
Mitya, he won't give it for anything.
I know he won't. I know it perfectly well. Now, especially,
"'That's not all. I know something more. "'Now, only a few days ago, perhaps only yesterday, "'he found out for the first time in earnest, "'underline in earnest,
"'that Grushenka is really perhaps not joking "'and really means to marry me. "'He knows her nature. He knows the cat. "'And do you suppose he's going to give me money to help "'to bring that about when he's crazy about her himself?'
And that's not all either. I can tell you more than that. I know that for the last 5 days he's had 3,000 drawn out of the bank, changed into notes of 100 rubles, packed into a large envelope, sealed with 5 seals, and tied across with red tape. You see how well I know all about it. On the envelope is written, "To my angel Grushenka, when she will come to me." He scrawled it himself in silence and in secret. And no one knows that the money's there except the valet, Smerdyakov, whom he trusts like himself. So now he's been expecting Grushenka for the last 3 or 4 days. He hopes she'll come for the money. He has sent her word of it, and she's sent him word that perhaps she'll come. And if she does go to the old man, can I marry her after that? You understand now why I'm here in secret and what I'm on the watch for.
For her?
Yes, for her. Foma has a room in the house of these sluts here. Foma comes from our parts. He was a soldier in our regiment. He does jobs for them. He's watchman at night and goes grouse shooting in the daytime. And that's how he lives. I've established myself in his room. Neither he nor the women of the house know the secret. That is, that I am on the watch here.
No one but Smerdyakov knows, then.
No one else. He will let me know if she goes to the old man.
It was he told you about the money, then?
Yes, it's a dead secret. Even Ivan doesn't know about the money or anything. The old man is sending Ivan to Termalchnya on a 2 or 3 days' journey. A purchaser has turned up for the copse. He'll give 8,000 for the timber, so the old man keeps asking Ivan to help him by going to arrange it. It'll take him 2 or 3 days. That's what the old man wants, so that Grushenka can come while he's away.
Then he's expecting Grushenka today?
No, she won't come today. There are signs. She's certain not to come,
cried Mitya suddenly.
Smerdyakov thinks so, too. Father's drinking now. He's sitting at a table with Ivan. Go to him, Alyosha, and ask for the 3,000.
"'Mitya, dear, what's the matter with you?'
cried Alyosha, jumping up from his place and looking keenly at his brother's frenzied face. For one moment the thought struck him that Dmitri was mad. "'What is it? I'm not insane,' said Dmitri, looking intently and earnestly at him. "'No fear. I'm sending you to Father, and I know what I'm saying. I believe in miracles.'
"'In miracles?'
In a miracle of divine providence, God knows my heart. He sees my despair. He sees the whole picture. Surely he won't let something awful happen.
Alyosha, I believe in miracles. Go. I'm going. Tell me, will you wait for me here?
Yes, I know it'll take some time. You can't go at him point blank. He's drunk now. I'll wait 3 hours, 4, 5, 6, 7. Only remember, you must go to Katerina Ivanovna today, if it has to be at midnight, with the money or without the money, and say, "He sends his compliments to you." I want you to say that verse to her. "He sends his compliments to you."
Mitya. And what if Grushenka comes today? If not today, tomorrow or the next day?
Grushenka. I shall see her. I shall rush out and prevent it. And if there's an if, it will be murder. I couldn't endure it.
Who will be murdered?
The old man shan't kill her.
Brother, what are you saying?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Perhaps I shan't kill him, and perhaps I shall. I'm afraid that he will suddenly become so loathsome to me with his face at that moment. I hate his ugly throat, his nose, his eyes, his shameless snigger. I feel a physical repulsion. That's what I'm afraid of. That's what may be too much for me.
I'll go, Mitya. I believe that God will order things for the best, that nothing awful may happen.
And I will sit and wait for the miracle. And if it doesn't come to pass...
Alyosha went thoughtfully towards his father's house. Chapter 6 Smerdyakov. He did, in fact,
find his father still at table. Though there was a dining room in the house, the table was laid as usual in the drawing room, which was the largest room, and furnished with old-fashioned ostentation. The furniture was white and very old, upholstered in old, red, silky material. In the spaces between the windows there were mirrors in elaborate white and gilt frames, of old-fashioned carving. On the walls, covered with white paper, which was torn in many places, there hung two large portraits, one of some prince who had been governor of the district 30 years before, and the other of some bishop, also long since dead. In a corner opposite the door there were several icons before which a lamp was lighted at nightfall, not so much for devotional purposes as to light the room. Fyodor Pavlovich used to go to bed very late at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and would wander about the room at night or sit in an armchair, thinking. This had become a habit with him. He often slept quite alone in the house, sending his servants to the lodge, but usually Smerdyakov remained, sleeping on a bench in the hall. When Alyosha came in, dinner was over, but coffee and preserves had been served. Fyodor Pavlovich liked sweet things with brandy after dinner. Ivan was also at table, sipping coffee. The servants, Grigory and Smerdyakov, were standing by. Both the gentlemen and the servants seemed in singularly good spirits. Fyodor Pavlovich was roaring with laughter. Before he entered the room, Alyosha heard the shrill laugh he knew so well, and could tell from the sound of it that his father had only reached the good-humoured stage, and was far from being completely drunk.
"Here he is! Here he is!"
yelled Fyodor Pavlovich, highly delighted at seeing Alyosha.
"Join us. Sit down. Coffee is a Lenten dish, but it's hot and good. I don't offer you brandy. You're keeping the fast. Would you like some? No, I'd better give you some of our famous liqueur. Smerdyakov, go to the cupboard, the second shelf on the right. Here are the keys. Look sharp."
Alyosha began refusing the liqueur.
"Never mind. If you won't have it, we will," said Fyodor Pavlovich, beaming. "But stay, have you dined?"
"Yes," answered Alyosha, who had in truth only eaten a piece of bread and drunk a glass of kvass in the Father Superior's kitchen, "though I should be pleased to have some hot coffee."
"Bravo, my darling, you'll have some coffee. Do you want warming?" "No, it's boiling. It's capital coffee Smerdyakov's making. My Smerdyakov's an artist at coffee, and at fish parties, and at fish soup, too. You must come one day and have some fish soup. Let me know beforehand. But stay, didn't I tell you this morning to come home with your mattress and pillow and all? Have you brought your mattress?"
"No, I haven't," said Alyosha, smiling too.
"Ah, but you were frightened. You were frightened this morning, weren't you? There, my darling, I couldn't do anything to vex you. Do you know, Ivan, I can't resist the way he looks one straight in the face and laughs. Makes me laugh all over. I'm so fond of him. Alyosha, let me give you my blessing, a father's blessing."
Alyosha rose, but Fyodor Pavlovich had already changed his mind.
"No, no," he said. I'll just make the sign of the cross over you for now. Sit still. Now, we've a treat for you, and your own line, too. It'll make you laugh. Balaam's ass has begun talking to us here, and how he talks, how he talks."
Balaam's ass, as it appeared, was the valet, Smerdyakov. He was a young man of about 24, remarkably unsociable and taciturn. Not that he was shy or bashful, on the contrary, he was conceited and seemed to despise everybody. But we must pause to say a few words about him now. He was brought up by Grigory and Marfa, but the boy grew up with no sense of gratitude, as Grigory expressed it. He was an unfriendly boy and seemed to look at the world mistrustfully. In his childhood he was very fond of hanging cats and burying them with great ceremony. He used to dress up in a sheet as though it were a surplice, and sang, and waved some object over the dead cat as though it were a censer. All this he did on the sly, with the greatest secrecy. Grigory caught him once at this diversion and gave him a sound beating. He shrank into a corner and sulked there for a week.
"He doesn't care for you or me, the monster," Grigory used to say to Marfa, "and he doesn't care for anyone. Are you a human being?"
he said, addressing the boy directly. "You're not a human being. You grew from the mildew in my bathhouse."
That's a proverbial expression in Russia.
"That's what you are."
Smerdyakov, it appeared afterwards, could never forgive him those words. Grigory taught him to read and write, and when he was 12 years old began teaching him the scriptures. But this teaching came to nothing. At the second or third lesson the boy suddenly grinned.
"What's that for?"
asked Grigory, looking at him threateningly from under his spectacles.
"Oh, nothing. God created light on the first day, and the sun, moon, and stars on the fourth day. Where did the light come from on the first day?"
Grigory was thunderstruck. The boy looked sarcastically at his teacher. There was something positively condescending in his expression. Grigory could not restrain himself.
"I'll show you where," he cried, and gave the boy a violent slap on the cheek.
The boy took the slap without a word, but withdrew into his corner again for some days. A week later, he had his first attack of the disease to which he was subject all the rest of his life, epilepsy. When Fyodor Pavlovich heard of it, his attitude to the boy seemed to change at once. Till then, he'd take no notice of him, though he never scolded him and always gave him a kopeck when he met him. Sometimes, when he was in good humor, he would send the boy something sweet from his table. But as soon as he heard of his illness, he showed an active interest in him, sent for a doctor, and tried remedies. But the disease turned out to be incurable. The fits occurred, on an average, once a month, but at various intervals. The fits varied, too, in violence. Some were light, and some were very severe. Fyodor Pavlovich strictly forbade Grigory to use corporal punishment of the boy, and began allowing him to come upstairs to him. He forbade him to be taught anything whatever for a time, too. One day, when the boy was about 15, Fyodor Pavlovich noticed him lingering by the bookcase and reading the titles through the glass. Fyodor Pavlovich had a fair number of books, over 100, but no one ever saw him reading. He at once gave Smerdyakov the key of the bookcase.
"Come read. You shall be my librarian. You'll be better sitting reading than hanging about the courtyard. Come read this."
And Fyodor Pavlovich gave him Evenings in a Cottage near Dikanka. He read a little but didn't like it. He did not once smile and ended by frowning.
"Why, isn't it funny?" asked Fyodor Pavlovich.
Smerdyakov did not speak.
"Answer, stupid."
"It's all untrue,"
mumbled the boy with a grin.
"Then go to the devil. You have the soul of a lackey. Stay. It's Smaragdov's Universal History. That's all true. Read that."
But Smerdyakov did not get through 10 pages of Smaragdov. He thought it dull, so the bookcase was closed again. Shortly afterwards, Marfa and Grigory reported to Fyodor Pavlovich that Smerdyakov was gradually beginning to show an extraordinary fastidiousness. He would sit before his soup, take up his spoon and look into the soup, bend over it, examine it, take a spoonful and hold it to the light.
"What is it, a beetle?"
Grigory would ask.
"A fly, perhaps," observed Marfa.
The squeamish youth never answered, but he did the same with his bread, his meat, and everything he ate. He would hold a piece on his fork to the light, scrutinize it microscopically, and only after long deliberation decide to put it in his mouth.
"Ugh, what fine gentleman's airs,"
Grigory muttered, looking at him. When Fyodor Pavlovich heard of this development in Smerdyakov, he determined to make him his cook, and sent him to Moscow to be trained. He spent some years there, and came back remarkably changed in appearance. He looked extraordinarily old for his age. His face had grown wrinkled, yellow, and strangely emasculate. In character he seemed almost exactly the same as before he went away. He was just as unsociable, and showed not the slightest inclination for any companionship. In Moscow, too, as we heard afterwards, he had always been silent. Moscow itself had little interest for him. He saw very little there, and took scarcely any notice of anything. He went once to the theatre, but returned silent and displeased with it. On the other hand, he came back to us from Moscow well-dressed, in a clean coat and clean linen. He brushed his clothes most scrupulously twice a day, invariably, and was very fond of cleaning his smart calf boots with a special English polish,
so that they shone like mirrors. He turned out a first-rate cook. Fyodor Pavlovich paid him a salary, almost the whole of which Smerdyakov spent on clothes, pomade, perfumes, and such things. But he seemed to have as much contempt for the female sex as for men. He was discreet, almost unapproachable, with them. Fyodor Pavlovich began to regard him rather differently. His fits were becoming more frequent, and on the days he was ill, Marfa cooked, which did not suit Fyodor Pavlovich at all.
"Why are your fits getting worse?"
asked Fyodor Pavlovich, looking askance at his new cook.
"Would you like to get married? Shall I find your wife?"
But Smerdyakov turned pale with anger and made no reply. Fyodor Pavlovich left him with an impatient gesture. The great thing was that he had absolute confidence in his honesty. It happened once, when Fyodor Pavlovich was drunk, that he dropped in the muddy courtyard 300-ruble notes, which he'd only just received. He only missed them next day, and was just hastening to search his pockets when he saw the notes lying on the table. Where had they come from? Smerdyakov had picked them up and brought them in the day before.
"Well, my lad, I've never met anyone like you," Fyodor Pavlovich said shortly, and gave him 10 rubles.
We may add that he not only believed in his honesty, but had, for some reason, a liking for him, although the young man looked as morosely at him as at everyone and was always silent. He rarely spoke. If it had occurred to anyone to wonder at the time what the young man was interested in and what was in his mind, it would have been impossible to tell by looking at him. Yet he used sometimes to stop suddenly in the house, or even in the yard or street, and would stand still for 10 minutes, lost in thought. A physiognomist studying his face would have said that there was no thought in it, no reflection, but only a sort of contemplation. There is a remarkable picture by the painter Kramskoy called Contemplation. There is a forest in winter, and on a roadway through the forest, in absolute solitude, stands a peasant in a torn caftan and bark shoes. He stands, as it were, lost in thought. Yet he's not thinking, he's contemplating. If anyone touched him, he would start and look at one as though awakening and bewildered. It's true he would come to himself immediately, but if he were asked what he'd been thinking about, he would remember nothing. Yet probably he has hidden within himself the impression which had dominated him during the period of contemplation. Those impressions are dear to him, and no doubt he hoards them imperceptibly, and even unconsciously. How and why, of course, he does not know either. He may, suddenly, after hoarding impressions for many years, abandon everything and go off to Jerusalem on a pilgrimage for his soul's salvation. Or perhaps he will suddenly set fire to his native village, and perhaps do both. There are a good many contemplatives among the peasantry. Well, Smerdyakov was probably one of them, and he probably was greedily hoarding up his impressions, hardly knowing why. Chapter 7. The Controversy. But Balaam's ass had suddenly spoken. The subject was a strange one. Grigory had gone in the morning to make purchases and had heard from the shopkeeper Lukyanov the story of a Russian soldier which had appeared in the newspaper of that day. The soldier had been taken prisoner in some remote part of Asia, and was threatened with an immediate agonizing death if he did not renounce Christianity and follow Islam. He refused to deny his faith, and was tortured, flayed alive, and died, praising and glorifying Christ. Grigory had related the story at table. Fyodor Pavlovich always liked, over the dessert after dinner, to laugh and talk, if only with Grigory. This afternoon he was in a particularly good-humoured and expansive mood. Sipping his brandy and listening to the story, he observed that they ought to make a saint of a soldier like that, and to take his skin to some monastery. That would make the people flock and bring the money in. Grigory frowned, seeing that Fyodor Pavlovich was by no means touched, but as usual was beginning to scoff. At that moment, Smerdyakov, who was standing by the door, smiled. Smerdyakov often waited at table toward the end of dinner, and since Ivan's arrival in our town, he had done so every day.
"What are you grinning at?"
asked Fyodor Pavlovich, catching the smile instantly and knowing that it referred to Grigory. "Well, my opinion is," Smerdyakov began suddenly and unexpectedly in a loud voice, "that if that laudable soldier's exploit was so very great, there would have been, to my thinking, no sin in it if he had on such an emergency renounced, so to speak, the name of Christ and his own christening, to save by that same his life for good deeds, by which in the course of years to expiate his cowardice. How could it not be a sin? You're talking nonsense. For that, you'll go straight to hell and be roasted there like mutton,"
put in Fyodor Pavlovich. It was at this point that Alyosha came in, and Fyodor Pavlovich, as we have seen, was highly delighted at his appearance.
"We're on your subject," he chuckled gleefully, making Alyosha sit down to listen.
"As for mutton, that's not so, and there'll be nothing there for this, and there shouldn't be either if it's according to justice,"
Smerdyakov maintained stoutly.
"How do you mean, according to justice?"
Fyodor Pavlovich cried still more gaily, nudging Alyosha with his knee.
"He's a rascal, that's what he is," burst from Grigory. He looked Smerdyakov wrathfully in the face.
"As for being a rascal, wait a little, Grigory Vasilyevich," answered Smerdyakov with perfect composure. "You better consider yourself that once I am taken prisoner by the enemies of the Christian race, and they demand from me to curse the name of God and to renounce my holy christening, I'm fully entitled to act by my own reason, since there'd be no sin in it."
"But you've said that before. Don't waste words. Prove it," cried Fyodor Pavlovich. "Soup maker," muttered Grigory contemptuously. "As for being a soup maker, wait a bit too and consider for yourself, Grigory Vasilyevich, without abusing me, for as soon as I say to those enemies, 'No, I'm not a Christian, and I curse my true God,' then at once, by God's high judgment, I become immediately and specially anathema accursed, and I'm cut off from the Holy Church exactly as though I were heathen, so that at that very instant, not only when I say it aloud, but when I think of saying it, before a quarter of a second has passed, I'm cut off. Is that so or not, Grigory Vasilyevich?"
He addressed Grigory with obvious satisfaction, though he was really answering Fyodor Pavlovich's questions, and was well aware of it, and intentionally pretending that Grigory had asked the questions.
"Ivan," cried Fyodor Pavlovich suddenly, "stoop down for me to whisper. He's got this all up for your benefit. He wants you to praise him. Praise him."
Ivan listened with perfect seriousness to his father's excited whisper.
"Stay, Smerdyakov, be quiet a minute," cried Fyodor Pavlovich once more. "Ivan, your ear again."
Ivan bent down again with a perfectly grave face.
"I love you as I do, Alyosha. Don't think I don't love you. Some brandy?"
"Yes.
But you're rather drunk yourself," thought Ivan, looking steadily at his father. He was watching Smerdyakov with great curiosity.
"You're anathema accursed as it is," Grigory suddenly burst out. "And how dare you argue, you rascal, after that, if—" "Don't scold him, Grigory, don't scold him,"
Fyodor Pavlovich cut him short.
"You should wait, Grigory Vasilyevich, if only a short time, and listen, for I haven't finished all I had to say. For at the very moment I become accursed, at that same highest moment, I become exactly like a heathen, and my christening is taken off me and becomes of no avail. Isn't that so?"
"Make haste and finish, my boy," Fyodor Pavlovich urged him, sipping from his wine glass with relish.
"And if I've ceased to be a Christian, then I told no lie to the enemy when they asked whether I was a Christian or not a Christian, seeing I had already been relieved by God himself of my Christianity, by reason of the thought alone, before I had time to utter a word to the enemy. And if I have already been discharged, in what manner and with what sort of justice can I be held responsible as a Christian in the other world for having denied Christ, when, through the very thought alone, before denying him, I had been relieved from my christening? If I'm no longer a Christian, then I can't renounce Christ, for I've nothing then to renounce. Who will hold an unclean Tatar responsible, Grigory Vasilyevich, even in heaven, for not having been born a Christian? And who would punish him for that, considering that you can't take two skins off one ox? For God Almighty himself, even if he did make the Tatar responsible,
when he dies, would give him the smallest possible punishment, I imagine, since he must be punishment. Judging that he is not to blame if he has come into the world an unclean heathen from heathen parents. The Lord God can't surely take a Tatar and say he was a Christian. That would mean that the Almighty would tell a real untruth. And can the Lord of heaven and earth tell a lie, even in one word?
Grigory was thunderstruck and looked at the orator, his eyes nearly starting out of his head. Though he did not clearly understand what was said, he had caught something in this rigmarole, and stood, looking like a man who has just hit his head against a wall. Fyodor Pavlovich emptied his glass and went off into his shrill laugh.
"Alyosha, Alyosha, what do you say to that? Ah, you casuist, he must have been with the Jesuits somewhere, Ivan. Oh, you stinking Jesuit, who taught you? But you're talking nonsense, you casuist. Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Don't cry, Grigory. We'll reduce him to smoke and ashes in a moment. Tell me this, oh ass. You may be right before your enemies, but you've renounced your faith all the same in your own heart, and you say yourself that in that very hour you became anathema accursed. And if once you're anathema, they won't pat you on the head for it in hell. What do you say to that, my fine Jesuit?
There is no doubt that I've renounced it in my own heart, but there was no special sin in that. Or, if there was sin, it was the most ordinary.
How's that, the most ordinary? You lie, accursed one, hissed Grigory.
Consider yourself, Grigory Vasilievich. Smerdyakov went on, staid and unruffled, conscious of his triumph, but, as it were, generous to the vanquished foe.
Consider yourself, Grigory Vasilievich. It is said in the scripture that if you have faith, even as a mustard seed, and bid a mountain move into the sea, it will move without the least delay at your bidding. Well, Grigory Vasilievich, if I'm without faith and you have so great a faith that you are continually swearing at me, you try yourself telling this mountain not to move into the sea, for that's a long way off, but even to our stinking little river which runs at the bottom of the garden. You'll see for yourself that it won't budge, but will remain just where it is. However much you shout at it, and that shows, Grigory Vasilievich, that you haven't faith in the proper manner, and only abuse others about it. Again, taking into consideration that no one in our day, not only you, but actually no one, from the highest person to the lowest peasant, can shove mountains into the sea, except perhaps some one man in the world, or at most two, and they most like they're saving their souls in secret somewhere in the Egyptian desert, so you wouldn't find them. If so it be, if all the rest have no faith, will God curse all the rest? That is, the population of the whole earth, except about two hermits in the desert? And in his well-known mercy, will he not forgive one of them? And so I'm persuaded that though I may once have doubted, I shall be forgiven if I shed tears of repentance. Stay, cried Fyodor Pavlovich in a transport of delight. So you do suppose there are two who can move mountains? Ivan, make a note of it, write it down. There you have the Russian all over.
You're quite right in saying it's characteristic of the people's faith, Ivan assented, with an approving smile.
You agree, then it must be so if you agree. It's true, isn't it, Alyosha? That's the Russian faith all over, isn't it?
No, Smerdyakov has not the Russian faith at all, said Alyosha firmly and gravely.
I'm not talking about his faith. I mean those two in the desert. Only that idea. Surely that's Russian, isn't it?
Yes, that's purely Russian, said Alyosha, smiling.
Your words are worth a gold piece, oh ass, and I'll give it to you today. But as to the rest, you talk nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Let me tell you, stupid, that we here are all of little faith, only from carelessness, because we haven't time. Things are too much for us, and in the second place, the Lord God has given us so little time, only 24 hours in the day, so that one hasn't even time to get sleep enough, much less to repent of one's sins. While you have denied your faith to your enemies when you've nothing else to think about but to show your faith, so I consider, brother, that it constitutes a sin.
Constitute a sin it may, but consider yourself, Grigory Vasilievich, that it only extenuates it if it does constitute. If I had believed then in very truth, as I ought to have believed, then it really would have been sinful if I had not faced tortures for my faith,
and had gone over to the pagan Mohammedan faith. But, of course, it wouldn't have come to torture them, because I should only have had to stay at that instant of the mountain, move and crush the tormentor, and it would have moved, and at the very instant have crushed him like a black beetle. And I should have walked away as though nothing had happened, praising and glorifying God. But suppose, at that very moment, I'd tried all that and cried to that mountain, "Crush these tormentors," and it hadn't crushed them. How could I have helped doubting, pray, at such a time, and at such a dread hour of mortal terror? And apart from that, I should know already that I could not attain to the fullness of the kingdom of heaven, for since the mountain had not moved at my word, they could not think very much of my faith up aloft, and there could be no very great reward awaiting me in the world to come. So, why should I let them flay the skin off me as well, and to no good purpose? For, even though they had flayed my skin half of my back, even then the mountain would not have moved at my word or at my cry. And at such a moment not only doubt might come over one, but one might lose one's reasons from fear, so that one would not be able to think at all. And therefore, how should I be particularly to blame, if not seeing my advantage or reward, there or here, I should at least save my skin. And so, trusting fully in the grace of the Lord, I should cherish the hope that I might be altogether forgiven. Chapter 8. Over the Brandy. The controversy was over. But strange to say, Fyodor Pavlovich, who had been so gay, suddenly began frowning. He frowned and gulped brandy, and it was already a glass too much.
"Get along with you, Jesuits," he cried to the servants. "Go away, Smerdyakov, I'll send you the gold piece I promised you today, but be off. Don't cry, Grigory. Go to Marfa, she'll comfort you and put you to bed. The rascals won't let us sit in peace after dinner." He snapped peevishly as the servants promptly withdrew at his word. "Smerdyakov always pokes himself in now after dinner. It's you he's so interested in. What have you done to fascinate him?"
he added to Ivan. "Nothing whatever," answered Ivan. "He's pleased to have a high opinion of me. He's a lackey and a mean soul. Raw material for revolution, however, when the time comes."
"A revolution?
There will be others and better ones. But there will be some like him as well. His kind will come first, and better ones after."
"And when will the time come?"
"The rocket will go off and fizzle out, perhaps. The peasants are not very fond of listening to these soup-makers, so far."
"Ah, brother, but a Balaam's ass like that thinks and thinks, and the devil knows where he gets to."
"He's storing up ideas," said Ivan, smiling.
"You see, I know he can't bear me, nor anyone else, even you, though you fancy that he has a high opinion of you. Worse still with Alyosha. He despises Alyosha, but he doesn't steal, that's one thing. And he's not a gossip. He holds his tongue and doesn't wash our dirty linen in public. He makes capital fish patties, too. But damn him, is he worth talking about so much?
Of course he isn't.
And as for the ideas he may be hatching, the Russian peasant, generally speaking, needs thrashing. That I've always maintained. Our peasants are swindlers and don't deserve to be pitied. And it's a good thing they're still flogged sometimes. Russia is rich in birches. If they destroyed the forests, it would be the ruin of Russia. I stand up for the clever people. We've left off thrashing the peasants. We've grown so clever, but they go on thrashing themselves. And a good thing, too. For with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. Or, how's it go? Anyway, it will be measured. But Russia's all swinishness. My dear, if you only knew I hate Russia. That is, not Russia, but all this vice. But maybe I mean Russia. Tout cela, c'est de la cochonnerie. Do you know what I like? I like wit.
You've had another glass. That's enough.
Wait a bit, I'll have one more, and then another, and then I'll stop. No, stay, you interrupted me. At Makroe, I was talking to an old man, and he told me, there's nothing we like so much as sentencing girls to be thrashed, and we always give the lads the job of thrashing them. And the girl he has thrashed today, the young man will ask in marriage tomorrow, so it quite suits the girls, too, he said. There's a set of desserts for you. But it's clever, anyway. Shall we go over and have a look at it, eh? Alyosha, are you blushing? Don't be bashful, child.
Sorry I didn't stay to dinner at the Superior's and tell the monks about the girls at Mokroe. Alyosha, don't be angry that I offended your superior this morning. I lost my temper. If there is a God, if he exists, then of course I'm to blame, and I shall have to answer for it. But if there isn't a God at all, what do they deserve, your fathers? It's not enough to cut their heads off, for they keep back progress. Would you believe it, Ivan, that lacerates my sentiments? No, you don't believe it, as I see from your eyes. You believe what people say, that I'm nothing but a buffoon. Alyosha, do you believe that I'm nothing but a buffoon?
No, I don't believe it.
And I believe you don't, and that you speak the truth. You look sincere, and you speak sincerely. But not Ivan. Ivan's supercilious. I'd make an end of your monks, though. All the same, I'd take all that mystic stuff and suppress it once for all over Russia, so as to bring all the fools to reason, and the gold and the silver that would flow into the mint.
But why suppress it? Asked Ivan.
Well, that truth may prevail, that's why.
Well, if truth were to prevail, you know, you'd be the first to be robbed and suppressed.
I dare say you're right. I'm an ass,
burst out Fyodor Pavlovich, striking himself lightly on the forehead.
Well, your monastery may stand then, Alyosha, if that's how it is, and we clever people sit snug and enjoy our brandy. You know, Ivan, it must have been so ordained by the Almighty himself. Ivan, speak, is there a God, or not? Stay, speak the truth, speak seriously. Why are you laughing again?
I'm laughing that you should have made a clever remark just now about Sperdyakov's belief in the existence of two saints who could move mountains.
Why? Am I like him now, then?
Very much.
Well, that shows I'm a Russian, too, and I have a Russian characteristic. And you may be caught in the same way, though you are a philosopher. Shall I catch you? What do you bet that I'll catch you tomorrow? Speak, all the same, is there a God or not, and be serious. I want you to be serious now.
No, there is no God.
Alyosha, is there a God?
There is.
Ivan, and is there immortality of some sort, just a little, just a tiny bit?
There is no immortality either.
None at all,
none at all.
There's absolute nothingness, then. Perhaps there's just something. Anything is better than nothing.
Absolute nothingness.
Alyosha, is there immortality?
There is.
God and immortality?
God and immortality, and God is immortality.
It's more likely Ivan's right. Good Lord, to think what faith, what force of all kinds man has lavished for nothing on that dream and for how many thousand years. Who is it laughing at man? Ivan, for the last time, once for all, is there a God or not? I ask for the last time.
And for the last time there is not.
Who is laughing at mankind, Ivan?
It must be the devil, said Ivan, smiling.
And the devil, does he exist?
No, there's no devil either.
It's a pity, damn it all, what wouldn't I do to the man who first invented God? Hanging on a bitter aspen tree would be too good for him.
There would have been no civilization if they hadn't invented God.
Wouldn't there have been without God?
No. And there would have been no brandy either, but I must take your brandy away from you anyway.
Stop, 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 dear boy. One more little glass. I've hurt Alyosha's feelings. You're not angry with me, Alyosha, my dear little Alexei.
No, I'm not angry. I know your thoughts. Your heart is better than your head.
My heart better than my head, is it? Oh, Lord, and that from you. Ivan, do you love Alyosha?
Yes.
You must love him.
Fyodor Pavlovich was by this time very drunk.
Listen, Alyosha, I was rude to your elder this morning, but I was excited. But there's wit in that elder, don't you think, Ivan?
Very likely.
There is. Il y a du Piron là-dedans. He's a Jesuit, a Russian one, that is. As he's an honourable person, there's a hidden indignation boiling within him at having to pretend and affect holiness.
But of course he believes in God.
Not a bit of it. Didn't you know? Why, he tells everyone so himself. That is, not everyone, but all the clever people who come to him. He said straight out to Governor Schultz not long ago, credo, but I don't know in what.